Support for this podcast and the following message come from Wise, the app that makes managing your money in different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money internationally at the mid-market exchange rate. No guesswork and no hidden fees. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com.
Today on State of the World, examining evidence of sexual violence during the October 7th attacks. Thanks for listening to State of the World from NPR. We bring you the day's most vital international stories up close where they're happening. It's Wednesday, March 13th. I'm Greg Dixon. We're going to spend some time in today's episode investigating some of the most horrific allegations of what happened during Hamas's attack on Israel October 7th. Just so you know, there will be some descriptions of violence. It is widely agreed that the Hamas-led assault involved a large-scale loss of life. Israel says more than 1,200 Israelis were killed that day. Israel also alleges that the attack involved numerous instances of sexual violence. This is a charge Hamas denies. NPR's Becky Sullivan has this story of one first responder's experience on October 7th and why investigating the allegations has been a challenge.
First responders reached the site of the Nova Rave around 10 p.m., about 16 hours after the Hamas assault began, and the bodies were everywhere. Hundreds of bloodied young men and women still dressed in their party clothes. One of the responders there was Chaim Otmazgan. I met him at his home near Tel Aviv. He's a reserve officer in the Israeli army and a commander in Zaka, the volunteer search and rescue group in Israel that specializes in recovering dead bodies. He was one of the first to reach the scene of the rave, which was the single deadliest site of the attack. We worked through the night, he tells me, tagging and bagging the bodies, one after the other, and loading them by the dozen into ambulances. One of the dead, he says, was a woman he found lying in the dirt, naked from the waist down. Her skirt had been lifted all the way up, he says. She had no underwear, and there was a bloody wound between her legs. I tried to pull her skirt down a little before taking a photo, he says. Otmazgan is an observant Orthodox Jew, and he thought it was an act of respect, since the photo was only meant to help identify the body later. At the time, he and the other first responders weren't thinking about how, months later, the world would question whether the attackers had committed sexual violence and that he had just inadvertently made that harder to prove. He says there wasn't even the thought to stop for a second and say, wait, we're here, let's be investigators. We don't have the tools for that, he says. It's not our job. Israel's case to the world has relied on the accounts of eyewitnesses and first responders like Otmazgan, who weren't trained in forensics. His story helps show some of the obstacles that investigators have faced, starting with the rave. As soldiers fought back throughout the day and worked to secure the area, he says, they moved bodies that they had found back to the central site of the rave. That made it easier to control the area, but it also compromised investigators' ability to understand how those victims had died. The scale of the attack staggered him, he told me. And so, too, did the condition of the bodies. Even when you're working like a machine, there are bodies that you encounter that make you feel like you've been punched in the stomach, he says. It's burned into your mind. There was the woman whose skirt he pulled down, another dressed in a rainbow sequin top, her white jeans stained with blood from a gunshot wound to her pelvic area. Later, he'd find the body of a woman who wasn't wearing a shirt. Her jean shorts had been hiked up and torn away to partially reveal her injured and bloodied groin. He showed those photographs and many others to me. They had to work quickly, he says. Rockets and gunfire were still ringing out. And they worried that if they left, any bodies they left behind might be abducted by Hamas. So Otmazgan says, you see, the person has been stripped of their clothes and you have to photograph, so you try to pull down the skirt a bit, take the photo, and then you pack the body up. All of that in 20 or 30 seconds, he says. A report released last week by the United Nations found reason to believe that rapes took place in at least three different locations on October 7th, including at the site of the rave. Skeptics have complained about the lack of firsthand testimony and forensic evidence. Pramila Patton, the author of the UN report, said last week that this was something that they encountered as they looked into the allegations.
One of the challenges faced by, of course, by the Israeli government, but which impacted our own work, was the fact that inaccurate, unreliable forensic conclusions were drawn by untrained volunteer first responders.
For example, the report said, sometimes a grazing gunshot wound to the genital area was mistaken for a targeted knife wound. I talked to a couple experts about other reasons why it can be hard to investigate this kind of thing. Karen Nehmer, a lawyer with Physicians for Human Rights, told me these types of crimes often take place amid ongoing combat, which makes it complicated to check out the crime scene.
People are not thinking a few steps ahead about how to use this window, this very limited window, to capture evidence that is ephemeral.
Jewish burial customs are another factor. Bodies are buried as soon as possible, usually the day after death. And after October 7th, Israeli officials chose to prioritize identifying the dead over forensic investigation of the bodies. Nehmer says that forensic evidence isn't always necessary for a court of law to make findings about sexual violence.
There is very much what's known as the CSI effect, where there is a perception that without forensic evidence or DNA, then you don't have a case. And that's just patently not true.
No survivors of sexual assault that day have come forward publicly. The UN report says they received credible information that a handful of survivors are alive, but most of the alleged victims of sexual violence are dead. Experts say it's not uncommon to lack that firsthand testimony when investigating these kinds of allegations, which is why the accounts of first responders, like Otmazgan, can be valuable, says Jessica Peake, a law professor at UCLA who has helped to investigate and prosecute human rights violations.
Those are the ones who are the first on the scene. They're really seeing with their own eyes, like, what has happened, what the aftermath of whatever the alleged attack is.
But sometimes a lack of neutrality can be a challenge, she says.
Particularly in a conflict situation, they're coming from one side or another, and so they're quite likely going in with maybe some preconceived notions of what they're expecting to find, and that colors what their understanding is ultimately of what they're seeing.
ZACA, the volunteer responder organization that Otmazgan belongs to, has come under scrutiny, too. It's not part of the Israeli government. They've faced accusations that their workers inadvertently mishandled potential evidence. And the accounts of some of their volunteers about what they saw after October 7th have been discredited. In response, ZACA has said its members are not pathology experts, and they don't have the professional tools needed to evaluate bodies or declare things like age or cause of death. Otmazgan acknowledges some of these shortcomings, and skeptics have seized on them. They accuse Israel of using the allegations to justify the intensity of its military actions in Gaza. But even as the UN report substantiates some of Israel's claims, its author, Pramila Patton, advocates for a ceasefire.
I am of the strong opinion that this finding does not in any way legitimize further violence, but actually reinforces the need for an urgent ceasefire, as continuing this war will not serve to protect hostages from risk of further sexual violence.
For Chaim Otmazgan, bearing witness has taken a toll. He says part of him is actually happy that people are skeptical. The human mind shouldn't be able to believe things like this, he says. So to feel doubt means you're normal. But when you suddenly hear that people don't believe what happened, says Otmazgan, you remember that feeling of being punched in the stomach. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
That's the State of the World from NPR. For more coverage of all sides of this conflict, go to npr.org/Mideast Updates. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show, Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.